Rouse, the Youngstown State University Oral History Program by John Jameson. We're at 12053 Market Street, North Lima, Ohio. The date is the 14th of July, and it's approximately 10:35 in the morning. Okay, Mr. Krause, would you give us a little background on where you grew up in your early years?
Well, I'm a hometown boy. I never got out of North Lima. I was born in North Lima in 1919, just about 2 miles from where I live now.
When you, did you have brothers and sisters when you
were? I got one brother, older brother.
Mm-hmm. Now, what did your parents do?
Well, my dad worked for the A&P Tea Company as a grocery store for 27 years. And of course, I grew up in an A&P store too when I was growing up as a boy. And when I got out of high school, I started working for A&P.
Now, when you graduated high school, would have been?
37.
Mm-hmm. Was your inclination to go into the service then, or?
No, I was drafted for a year.
Prior to the war?
Pardon me? Prior to the war, yes. 1941.
Hmm.
That's when FDR said, "We'll never send your boys overseas."
Yeah. Now, you would have been about, what, 21, 22 when you were drafted?
22, yeah.
What, do you remember the month that you
went in? October, yeah. I was in the service from October of 1941 to October of 1945.
Jeez. So you were in already when the
Pearl
war started.
Harbor, right. Mm-hmm.
Was there a feeling prior to Pearl Harbor that, you know, something was going to happen?
Oh, yeah.
That you guys were going to go?
Yes. Everybody knew that we'd end up in a war.
Do you remember where you were when Pearl Harbor started?
Yeah, I was in New York City. I was on leave in New York City. And of course, they announced everything. Everybody returned to your base. And they had brought, I was stationed in Red Bank, New Jersey at Fort Monmouth. And we had a weekend pass to New York City. And they had sent trucks from the base to pick up all the soldiers that were on leave in New York City. And we piled, I don't know how many was in those trucks going back to Red Bank.
Hmm. Now, when you first went in, what was your basic training in?
I started in Fort Monmouth.
That was in
Signal
New Jersey?
Signal Corps, yeah. When I was drafted in October, they sent us to Fort Hays in Columbus. Mm-hmm. And this is before they even had uniforms or a rifle to give us. We started basic training in our civilian clothes. And of course, you know, the Army was not prepared at that time. And we were sitting down at Fort Hays for about a week with nothing to do, waiting for an assignment. Finally, they come out and says, "Anybody can type 30 words a minute or better, step forward." Well, I was anxious to get out of there, so I volunteered. I could type. I took typing in high school, and I kept it up. And that's how I got into Signal Corps, because I could type.
So how long in basic were you?
It was 3 months, I think, was basic training. Anyways, I was sent to Fort Monmouth with four of my buddies who worked for Ohio Bell here in Youngstown. A couple of them I went to school with. So we stayed together in Fort Monmouth until we were separated, and then we went to all parts of the world.
Now, Fort Monmouth, was that a Signal Corps?
Signal Corps, yeah. That is the old base Signal Corps, right. This is where they still trained pigeons. When I got there, they had quite a pigeon lot.
Really?
That was one of their forms of communication, transport communication, yeah.
What was a typical day like at Fort Monmouth?
Well, this is back in the early part of the war, before the war, really. But they had just, Fort Monmouth was a base, as I said, and it was all brick buildings. And then when they started to the buildup of the soldiers and so on, who were drafted, the draftees, they just built these buildings all over this marsh land. Really, it was a swamp where they built it. And when I got there, there were just one or two of the barracks that were up. And they had boards everywhere that you could walk, and this was in October. You had to stay on the boards or you went up to your knees in mud.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But they still had, the old part of Fort Monmouth was, they had their drill fields, and this is where we had our basics.
So you really never went to basic in Columbus then?
No.
Was it all Signal Corps guys at your basic training?
Yeah, this is all Signal Corps. This was the old basic. You learned shoulder a rifle, and which we didn't have. We had broomsticks at that time. But we went through the manual of arms and our basic training of marching, you know.
Do you remember anything that was particularly difficult for you there?
No, not really, because we went to typing school. Of course, I could type as fast or as good as anybody that was there. And then from there, we went into cryptography.
Mm-hmm.
That was what they put me into. I didn't volunteer for that.
Now,
and of course, you know what cryptography is. It goes in cipher.
Codes.
Yeah.
I want to talk about that in a little bit of detail. What do you remember? Did they eventually get you some rifles to practice with?
No, never had a rifle. When we went to target practice, they just threw a rifle at us and we shot it two or three times, and that's all.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the Signal Corps, our basic firearm was a sidearm, Colt 45.
So you carried one of those?
Yeah, I had a Colt 45 issued to me when I got overseas.
Mm-hmm. Now, how long are you going to be here at Fort Monmouth?
I think we were there. Well, we left the States from Fort Monmouth, really. We went into a camp in New York. I can't think of the name of that camp where the soldiers debarked from. It was close to Fort Dix, but it wasn't Fort Dix. There was another one there. And we was in there one or two nights. And then we sailed for parts unknown at that time.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't tell us where we were going.
You have any idea what time of the year you left?
Oh, that was in January.
Of 40,
that would have been 42, right? Okay. January of 42, when we left the States.
Do you remember anything about the trip or what kind of ship it was?
Yeah. One of the worst times of my life during the war, I think, even with all I went through in the next 4 years, was that trip across the Atlantic, because this is when Germans' U-boats was sinking boats right outside, you might say, of New York Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
And we were on the ocean somewhere around 31 or 34 days. I just can't remember. It was over 30 days.
Because big ship?
No, it was one of the last ships of the British Empire that got out of Singapore. And they converted it into a troop ship without much doing to it. It was stink. You could hardly stand the odor down where we were supposed to sleep. And where they put us fellows, we were right by the screw, you know, the propeller. And many nights, the propeller would come out of the water, you know, from the rough sea. And then you could just hear it whine. It would really take off and come out of the water, scare the dickens out of you.
Did it?
But the food was terrible. You couldn't eat hardly anything of the food. It was British rations, you might say, and it was just terrible. It's a wonder we really survived.
Do you remember losing weight on the trip?
Oh, yeah. Somebody was making money on the boat, and they were selling apples and oranges for about a dime a piece, and this is really what you lived on the whole length of the trip. Till we got to Iceland, this convoy stopped in Iceland for a couple days, and then we did get a little better food there for a couple days when we were in Iceland, waiting for some more ships to come into this convoy. And I think this is where the escorts parted. In other words, they went as far as Iceland and then they went back to the States. And then we were picked up by real little, we had good escorts going across to Iceland, big wagons, and then when we left Iceland, we just had these little corvettes, is all you'd see floating out in and out of the convoy. They were Canadian, they said, Canadian corvettes.
Did you see anybody get torpedoed on the trip?
No, but they dropped depth charges almost constantly.
Mm.
You just hear them. But when they dropped those, the whole boat would shake, you know, shouldn't be that close to you. So we were being chased. We knew that our life was in danger.
Mm. Now, you're going to arrive in England in early 42.
I got in Belfast, Ireland in 42.
Okay. Did they immediately assign you to a...
When we got to Belfast, we spent one night in Belfast, and the next morning they put us on a boat and we crossed the Irish Sea into Scotland. And we got into Scotland, Glasgow, I believe it was. Glasgow, Scotland. They put us on a train and we took an overnight train. It's almost a 24-hour trip, I believe, at that time, from Scotland down to London.
Now, all this time, you really don't have too much of an idea where you're going to be and what your job will be.
We still don't know where we're... I guess maybe at that time we didn't know we were going to London.
What unit were you assigned to there?
We had our own company. This was a company that went across on this boat. It was the 827 Signal Company. One little other story I should tell you before I forget it is, while we were in New York, before we left, they had us loading our equipment. Of course, we had teletypes and we had all kinds of office equipment, papers and pencils and code machines. And we had a couple Jeeps that was assigned to our company. And at the last minute, we were going to go on this ship. At the last minute, they changed our plans and they put us on this Duchess of Athol, was the name of this boat we went across on, Athol, Athol. We had another name for it by the time we got there. I don't need to tell you what it was. It's a bad name.
Now,
you can erase that if you
want. No, I bet that's okay. Now, the equipment that you used, and I wanted to get a little bit of background on that.
Yeah.
You say teletype and what?
Code machines.
Code machines, yeah.
Sagamas, they were called. I can tell you that now, Sagamas.
Were they anything like the Enigma machine that we read about in that...
They're all the same. They all work on a series of you have five all the code machines are the same principle. The wheels. You either have five wheels, three wheels, five wheels, or seven wheels, or you can have as many as you want. And each wheel has got 25 letters on it, which is the alphabet. And they all go from, they're all wired the same, and it all depends where you start your system. If you know where to start and set them up and you have the same equipment, you can break any code there is. And this, of course, is what the English did when they were able to break the German codes. They had this big machine that they could put any formula of these wheels any way they came up, and eventually they could break the message.
Mm-hmm.
I had a little bit of that. I had a little bit of that training when I got to London, but that would drive you crazy. You know, you'd sit there with this message and you'd go through all the possibilities and try to break it. Yeah, I was glad to get out of that.
Now, you're assigned to London. Whereabouts do you... Remember where you went?
Sure. The first place we stayed, I remember we were the first United States soldiers, the first Yankees in London. And we stayed with a British, in the British barracks, which is on James Street, St. James Park, which is just 100 yards from Buckingham Palace, right downtown London. And then our first headquarters were the American Embassy in Grosvenor Square, which was about a half a mile from where we were buried, where our barracks were with the Limeys. And we were there and their food was terrible. We were on Limey rations, which was basically potatoes, cabbage, and mutton. That was your main meal every day.
Now, I remember. Do you recall a difference when you were first there? They probably... Pretty friendly towards the end with all the...
Yeah, it was Yankee, yeah. When we first got there, we were invited out to different homes. Now, remember, this was every night almost when I got there, the Germans were still bombing.
Mm-hmm. Blitz still?
Well, it wasn't the Blitz, they just, the nuisance raids. Just come over to keep the people awake at night, you know? Mm-hmm. But we were invited out to different homes, and I remember there was only roughly 60 of us who arrived there, the first Yankees in town. And of course, this was before they had any Red Cross clubs or anything, nothing for us to do, so we were invited into the British counterpart, the USO, the Red Cross clubs. American Eagle Club was one of the first, and I made a recording at the American Eagle and sent home to my parents, which was a money-making affair, too. These people recorded your message, and then they sold the record to your parents. Yeah, we still have it.
Was it on a phonograph?
Yeah, on a 78.
Oh, yeah. Now, towards the end, when you, if you recall, with a million Americans, you probably weren't much of a novelty after that.
Oh, no. No. Of course, you know, it's like anything else. When you get that many troops there, and London was a, everybody wanted to spend their five-day pass in London, you know. And when the colored boys, maybe I shouldn't talk about this, when the colored boys came, they were called the American Indians. And the girls just over there just went crazy for these American Indians. And of course, that didn't go down so good either. But there were bad ones. A lot of them came to town, shot up the town, you know. They go to shoot it up, and they got drunk, and they carry on and so forth, like any other town. Everybody wanted to come to London because you could get things in London you couldn't get anywhere else. Everybody knew where the black market was. As soon as they got to London, they knew where they could get a bottle of scotch or they could get eggs and a steak or something like that. You know, word spread fast if you had the money. And these guys had the money to do it because you know they said the American soldier was overpaid.
I heard the quote, overpaid, oversexed, and over here.
Yeah.
I thought that was cute. Now, your first assignment in London, there probably wasn't a whole lot to do early in the war. You were just...
Oh, no, it was more or less just training. We had set up, in our company, there were 60 of us, and all of us was corporals.
Mm-hmm.
When I got in the Army, I was a corporal the first week I was in Fort Monmouth because they didn't have any cadre. And the only reason I was appointed a corporal was, this was an acting corporal, but you were allowed to wear the stripes, was because I was over 6 foot tall and I had a good build, you know? That's the way they picked them. But then when we got over to London, we were appointed corporal and pretty soon we were sergeant. We went right up the ladder.
Hmm.
And out of the 60 of us original boys, 10 of them were master sergeants. And these 10 came out of Washington, out of the main headquarters in Washington. And they set up pretty much the standard operating procedure for the whole European theater. They followed that from there on.
Hmm.
And these 10 master sergeants soon were second Louis, and then they went up the ladder. They were smart boys.
Now the job that you eventually are going to be in was communications. Mm-hmm. How far did this communication range?
London was, their call there was JBJB, and that was, at that time you only had, outside of the Philippines, I guess they hadn't fallen yet, and MacArthur's command, but you had London, which was the main headquarters away from Washington. This is where everything was going to happen. Mm-hmm. From everything that took place from there on started here in our headquarters in London. Mm-hmm. At the embassy.
How big was the place you worked?
Well, the American Embassy is a mammoth place, and actually our offices where we worked was a building owned by Doug Fairbanks.
Hmm.
And so you know it was his home in the West End of London, so it was pretty fancy.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah.
I remember the bathrooms; they were all glass anywhere you looked. Except the ceiling, but all the way around was glass, and you could see yourself in any part of the bathroom.
Now, is that going to be the place you're going to stay for the entire rail?
No.
How long are you going to be there?
We were there probably close to a year. The main headquarters in London, was a big department store at Oxford Circus. Anybody knows anything about London, there's two big parts of London. The Mayfair section, which is the West End, and the Piccadilly, which is downtown. We were in the Mayfair section, which was the class part of London. This is where all the rich people lived. You know, they still had a class system in London. Mm-hmm. And this big department store was known as Selfridges. It would be like May Company or the Horn Company or something like that. But it was a big building. It was for London. I think it had three or four floors high. Mm. But it had two levels of basement. And this was good for me because later on during the war, when we got hit with a V2, almost a direct hit, I was two floors underground, and that's the only reason that I'm sitting here today, because the concussion got into the elevator shaft and went up instead of going down. And of course, we were really bombed that night. Electric and everything was gone. And just like dust, you know, what would happen when the ceiling came down and so on and so on.
Now the V2s came towards the end of the war.
That was the end of the war, yeah.
Pretty effective weapon?
The V1s, the buzz bombs, that's the one that caused all the problems.
Really?
Yeah. I'll tell you more about that.
Okay.
But anyways, the Selfridges was this big department store, and of course it was completely renovated. Made offices and the signal corps, the communication end of it, was two floors underground. Hmm. For safety's sake and for security's sake. You didn't get down, you didn't get down to that part of it without a pretty good check, you know. Mm-hmm.
What, tell me a little bit about the security there. Was.
Oh yeah, well, it was the military police guarded the entrances, and you had to show your pass to go to the restroom, or you went somewhere to get a cup of coffee, you had to show your pass. And to get into the code room, it was just like jail. In other words, bars all around the code room, very secret. In other words, you couldn't see in or see out. And to get into that, you had to really have your what we call the blue pass. And that was a pass that you could get into the American Embassy with too. Hmm. Blue pass.
Was there ever any attempt made or a fear
of
an
attempt?
Not to my
knowledge, no.
So they kept it pretty secure.
We were all armed back there. We had Tommy guns, we had 45s, Tommy mm-hmm. guns, Thompson machine guns. And of course, we were all armed with our 45s, which we didn't carry, you know, didn't wear them all the time, but we had them with us most. When we went to work, we wore them.
Hmm. Now the communication that is gonna come in and out of this center, it's going to originate in Washington, and
yeah, Washington is the main headquarters. In other words, everything came from Marshall's office. He was a chief of staff, you know, and General Marshall ran the whole war as far as that goes. But this is before the days of Eisenhower and so mm-hmm. on. This is before the days of the African campaign.
The African Corps still going on. How did the messages come in on radio?
Yeah, we had. We had a big radio room, probably when things really got going, we probably had close to 40, 50 men working in just in the radio room. And this was high-speed radio.
Morse code?
No, you didn't. Morse code is a thing of the past. We had much quicker things than that. We had cable, we had the use of Western Union's cable, which mm-hmm. went across from New York to London. It was available to us for urgent messages. And things that you wanted to make sure would get across without any problems with the atmosphere. Atmospheric, mm-hmm. The sunspots especially would cause a lot of radio problems.
Did you do any actual radio work or just decoding?
No, I couldn't stand that radio work. No, I was in cryptography from the time I was in Fort Monmouth till I got out.
Now, they would come in with a message from the radio room, and
yeah.
Was it your job to decode and pass it on?
Yeah, I started out, I was strictly a cryptographer. I could do anything except for the eyes only. In other words, the message was real top secret, and in the first line you read, for the eyes of General so-and-so only, then they had certain people there who decoded those. Hmm. Eventually, though, I did that too.
Hmm. Now, how much of a coordination was there between American direction and the British running that end of them?
Yeah, we had a British code machine in our code room. They didn't have one of ours. No, the reason for that, when you go back to Dunkirk, when England lost practically everything they had, they left some code machines over there. And they were outdated. They were still the same code machines they used in the First World War. Very, very slow. They might run maybe 10 words a minute, where ours would, as fast as you could type, you could run. Mm. Yeah. But every now and then, we would get a message in British code, somewhere from England. They'd want it to get to our place in Washington, and it would come through our office, and we'd usually decode it and then put it in our code and send it to Washington. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, as the war starts to gear up towards Normandy, towards the invasion plan, well, of course, there were other shorter, smaller invasions before that. What do you recall about the...
Well, Torch, Operation Torch, was the African invasion.
Yeah.
Eisenhower, of course, was in England at that time. He was general of ETO USA, European Theater, we call it. And when the African invasion was gearing up, Eisenhower set up his initial headquarters at... Gibraltar, the Rock. Mm-hmm. And of course, this was good. He was drawing from our troops in North Ireland. They were going to leave North Ireland and go into Africa. And he was drawing from our communications center headquarters, European Theater. And out of our code group, we lost, I believe, about maybe 20 men who were top men then. And I was an alternate to go. One of the guys got sick, thank goodness. I didn't have to go.
You weren't too keen on going to Gibraltar?
No, I didn't want to go. I didn't want to go to that end of it. But they took us out to the 8th Air Force. These boys went down to Flying Fortress's B-17, and they had to man the side guns because this was a one-way trip on these airplanes. They were going into, they were leaving London, going into the Air Force in Africa. So these people were leaving London. The boys had to man the wing, I guess it was the wing guns. But anyways, they took us out, and I was out there, and they put us through, you know, how to aim them up and down and so on. And I went through that, but I didn't have to go to Africa.
After the Africa campaign, which was pretty successful, what's gonna come next? What do you
recall? Well, this is a big, Normandy, you know, we call it. Everything had a code name, you know.
That was
Overlord.
Overlord. Right?
Overlord. Yes, this was the anything that pertained to the invasion in the message somewhere. It says this pertains to Overlord, or this was Torch, or this was whatever, you know. And mm-hmm. And then during the invasion, they had the beaches, which was gold, and Juno, and the big one was. Omaha was a bad one.
That was the real hot one. Mm-hmm. Now the planning must have been over a considerable period of time.
Yeah. I got to tell you this, every ship that left the States, the message was sent to us that we had, they couldn't send anything in clear text. Everything had to be encoded. Everything that was on a boat, from a washer to a knife or a fork or a spoon, the quantity of them and what hole they were in, we had to decode this. Mm-hmm. This got to be real manifest. They call them manifests. Mm-hmm. The boys in our code room kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And we take the boys that could type real good out in the teletype section and bring them in because encoding is all, the code machine has the same keyboard as a typewriter. And you can run a typewriter, you can run a code machine. The only thing is they had to be cleared. In other words, he just didn't take somebody out here and put him in the code room. He had to, they had to come back home, and I never will forget, I had a letter from my folks. They said, well, know what I did, because FBI was down here in North Lima checking up on me.
Oh, really? They were asking questions
about my character and so on, you know.
How much could you tell your folks?
Nothing.
What'd you tell them?
I just said, I'm all right, I'm not in trouble. No, you couldn't tell them all what you were doing. Matter of fact, for a long time, they didn't even know I was in London, you know.
Really?
Yeah.
Where did your letters come from?
Well, APO number.
Uh-huh. Were they censored?
Everything was censored, yeah.
You think they would have been more secure knowing that you were doing something like that than...
Oh, no, because when you're in the Army, you know, anything can happen to you. Just like the buzz bombs, you know, I don't like to brag about it, but I probably saw more gunfire in London than most of the boys did on the battlefield.
Now tell me a little bit about the buzz bombs. They were the V1, they were the slower ones.
Right. First one I can tell you about the first one. Where we slept, I had my buddy, we had double bunks, and my buddy was chief radio man in my platoon. And we heard this funny noise, and he says, hey, he woke me up, and he says, that don't sound like, what is that? I said, I never heard that sound before. And pretty soon the sound quit. It just sounded like a motorcycle going up the road, you know? Real rough running engine. The engine died out. It wasn't long before there was a terrible explosion. Mm. Now you got to remember, during the peak, after the invasion, it was about two weeks into the invasion, Hitler unleashed this terrible secret weapon he had, and it was terrible, believe me. I've read how many, but offhand I can't tell you, but when it first started, there's one every 3 minutes coming into London somewhere. Mm. This is before they had any defense. They weren't a fast machine. After they found out they could knock them out of the air, they'd send the Spitfires up, and they just sort of tip them, you know, with the wings, these guys, and they'd get this automatic pilot thing off. They could run them down, and they could shoot them down. England, the British had their forces in Hyde Park, they had their ACAG guns where they'd shoot a jury coming over at night. I never saw them hit one because they had these powerful searchlights, and they'd be up in the sky, you know, and they'd pick out this airplane, and you'd see the tracers going, but you'd never see them hit it. Hmm. But anyways, they sent all their ACAG guns down to the southern coast of England to try to shoot them down. And then they did slow down for quite a while. But when one of these had landed, remember, it would destroy a city block.
The V1s?
Yes. Actually, there were more people killed with these things than there were during the Blitz.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, the V2s came a little later. They were...
Well, yeah, they were just every now and then one would come over. They weren't too serious. He didn't have too many of those.
Right.
But, you know, they were working on one to go to New York.
I read that, yeah.
Yeah. They were working on one that would have enough power to land in New York.
Shaking things up there. Now, how early does the Overlord planning start? The Operation Overlord. How early did it start, and what do you recall about the earliest?
Well, I don't know. Every now and then you'd get a list of code names that we'd have to post. Overlord had a Neptune was the very first part of Overlord. That was everything Neptune concerning the invasion. Mm-hmm. Overlord was the invasion, you know. And Neptune started probably right after the African War, right after, probably 43.
Did you have a clear conception of what was going to happen, or was it pretty much...
Oh, no, we knew everything that was going on. We even knew the date 2 weeks before the invasion. We knew the date, yeah.
I want to get into some more specifics. Yeah. In a little bit.
Yeah.
Everybody pretty much knew it was going to come.
Oh, yeah. Germans knew it was coming, sure.
Okay, let me see. Oh, we are here on this tape. Yeah, we can listen. Now, the plan is for sometime in the summer of 44.
44.
What do you recall about coordinating the messages? Who had to be notified and who?
Right after Eisenhower, when Eisenhower came back from Africa, he set up what they called SHAFE, SH, Supreme Headquarters, Allied Expeditionary Forces, SHAFE. Mm-hmm. And everything then was starting to, the real secret stuff was coming out of that office instead of our headquarters, which was still in the Selfridge building. We had transferred some of our men into SHAFE naturally, and they had their own headquarters, which was outside of London a little bit. But still, they'd get rushed, and we'd have to do some of their work for them because they didn't have the cable. We had the cable in our place. Mm. Everything, by that time, then we had high-speed radio, which between two points you could send secret. You could send clear text without being intercepted. Hmm. This was a real big thing. Between two points, this hmm. worked in the same system as an airplane pilot flies on a line, you know?
But you had to be...
That's right, but anybody right. got in between it or intercepted or would break it, and then it would become garbled. And they were using all of that.
Now the...
But the real secret stuff still had to be encoded. Now there's one other part I should tell you, because our office handled all the communications between Churchill and FDR. You read about his talks they would have together, you know, their conferences, and that all went through our office.
Now there was a bit of a controversy over appointing Eisenhower to the head job. What do you recall
Yeah, I don't know much about that. Just what I've read since that, the British wanted one of their boys to be the head dog. And of course, we were going to furnish the men, and we were going to furnish the material, and we furnished the money. So it was only natural that we would have American as a leader. Because it ended up that way. We had so many more troops than the British. Of course, the British had been fighting the war for 4 years, you know, and they were running out. They were running out of men.
Now the invasion is going to be June of 44.
June 44. June 5 it was originally set up, yeah. And it was delayed 24 hours.
Now there, from everything I've read, there was certain conditions that they were looking for in terms of the tide, in terms of the moonlight. Mm-hmm. What do you recall about those things?
No, I wasn't in on any of that.
Really?
That was decided at SHAFE. All that material was done at SHAFE headquarters.
But it was originally set for the 5th, and they called it off for a day?
Yeah, kind of the weather. The weather was so bad, and they really was in their favor that they went across, because, you know, the Germans weren't expecting us. Mm-hmm. Rommel had left his post. He had gone home for a leave, and because they knew that, or they felt sure there wouldn't be any invasion that night, because with the condition of the sea was terrible.
What role did you play, or maybe you recall the attempt to deceive the Germans, making them think we were going to Calais?
No, that was all done through the British run that pretty much. Mm-hmm. That was a British enterprise. They were good at the deception, you know.
Secret messages that they knew could be broken, and
well, yeah, we put on a lot of pre-invasion to keep the Germans thinking, you know, well, something's going to happen in the next few, because we would just flood the air with dummy messages. We'd have everybody. We'd take three or four guys off of our regular line, and they'd just write dummy messages put them on the air, and they'd send them on the air, and they'd fill the air with this stuff. And the Germans, of course, would interstate. They intercepted everything that we put out. And when they saw these messages coming, they'd say, gee, something's going to happen. Well, when the invasion started, this is the way it was. I mean, the air was just filled with, you can imagine. Mm-hmm.
But they didn't know if that was a real
thing
coming?
course, our communication, when we went across, this was a well-planned invasion, I'll tell you. Even we took our own drinking water, we took our own cable with us, we took our own, we had a ship out there, we had a communication and sitting out in the middle of the sea that everything was coming through to us. We were in direct contact with them. And the troops went ashore. Of course, they were using what they call their field code. In all my time, I think I only decoded one message that was in the field code, and that was delivered. You're gonna get this. That was delivered to from over after the invasion. It was delivered by a pigeon. And we figured the only way it could have got into our place, because it was one of the real cheap field code machines. I can't think of the name. M15, I guess it was. Nobody in our place knew how to run it.
But it actually came over from Normandy on a pigeon.
Came from somebody in France.
Jeez, that's amazing.
That's amazing, isn't it?
Okay, I'm going to flip this tape over. We're running out. I don't want to get... So I'm going to stop the tape and go to side two. There.
Well, now, that was, like I said, that went to another headquarters there. And we took the overload of that. Mm-hmm. Of course, we had plenty of that too.
Was there?
Marshall, of course, was here. He was in England during the invasion.
Oh, okay. Yes,
he was here. So that eliminated a lot of going back to Washington. And then we got overloaded with the Department of Office of War, Office of the correspondence, what do they call them? War Information, OWI, I guess it was. That all their stuff had to be censored in London before it could go over here. And then we would get it from the censors and we would send it to Washington.
Did that have to be encoded?
That had to be encoded too, and then it would be paraphrased and taken out what they wanted out over there the very beginning, right after the invasion. Because some of these guys, they were just writing everything, you know, really. Eisenhower had four or five main guys that was attached to him personally. And that was censored in London. Yeah, we got all that. And then they were released to the London papers from that too, you know. Hmm.
Now the invasion was pretty massive, hundreds of thousands of men and tons of material. What did you know about this as it was going on? Did they have very much?
No, everything was pretty dead there. The first 24 hours, it was touch and go in Omaha. The other beaches, the Canadians and the British, they didn't find too much opposition. But we just landed at a bad spot. We landed where Rommel seemed to think we were going to land. And of course, Hitler still thought we were going to land in Pas-de-Calais, you know, up in the Dover area there. And that was the deception. This is what the big part that England played in that, because they had played this up and they released it in the papers and everything. The Patton's Secret Army was still in England, you know? All the time, Patton was over there already.
Was he?
Oh yeah.
Now from what I understand, Hitler and made Rommel keep his reserves back in case
they still thought. They still thought we had another army coming across. From, mm-hmm. What was it, 13 mile across there or something like that?
To Calais, would have been disastrous if they.
Yeah, this is where they had their main defense. You mm-hmm. know, you couldn't have got into that. You know.
Now, as the invasion is a success and they drive across France, what do you recall about those days?
Well, we get a morning report from G2, and as I say, we were the hub, and we'd send that all over the different we would write it up, it would be written up and encoded in our office here, and then that would go out to Washington, to Algiers, and would go to the Europe, the Pacific Theater. Can't remember where that went, but it used to go to India, and it went everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a pretty much a synopsis of what happened the day before, what had been cleared, what had been gone through censorship.
Do you think you got a little bit more information than, say, a standard soldier would have been able to get?
We knew what was going on. We knew there, when there was a big battle, there'd be an urgent need for something, you know.
Hmm. Now, the war went pretty well after they're in France and...
Well, after the breakout at St. Lo, yeah.
Breezing across France pretty well until the fall,
then they took Paris. And when they took Paris, they took our headquarters, cut us in half, took half of our personnel from London, and they went to Paris.
Did you stay in London?
I stayed in London. I got left behind every time.
Did you feel good about that?
Yeah, yes and no. I don't know. I'd like to see Paris. I'd like to see France. But then a buddy of mine, George Croxall, is down here in East Liverpool. Started out with me in the old 827 in Fort Monmouth. He went to Paris and he ended up at Nuremberg Trials. He was in the army 6-7 years.
Hmm.
Couldn't get out. He was one of the guys they wouldn't let go. Same home. He was home on a 90-day leave or something like that. Had to go back again.
He was pretty good at his job, then.
Oh yeah, he was good.
But
I mean, he wasn't any better than the rest of us. It's just that he got. Circumstances, you know, he went to Paris, and then after things died in Paris, boy, they sort of he was in the shaft with Eisenhower, and they just moved right along.
Now, as the it's going pretty well, and of course, that winter was the big
Battle of the Bulge.
Battle of the Bulge, and how critical was that?
Battle of the Bulge almost licked us. Matter of fact, in two ways. We had more casualties during the Battle of the Bulge than we did in any other army, any other conflict, any other part of the war,
mm-hmm.
really.
Could you sense that concern there?
Well, yeah, because, hey, everything was putting a pinch on us. For instance, they took, they started to take some of our rations away from us, some of our clothes. Being in London, we were supposed to. We always had to look nice, you know. And we had the best of clothes there was. And the average soldier had one change of clothes. I think we had four or five.
Hmm.
Before we could. We always was dressed up, really, always. But then they started taking some of our pants. And we had long underwear. We never used them in London, but they took them. And boots. We all had goulashes, so we never used them. They took that kind of stuff because this was right in the dead of winter when this war mm-hmm. was going, when the Battle of the Bulge was going on. Right, it started at Christmas time, before Christmas. And then things really did speed up because everything became urgent. You know, they were running out of guns, they were running out of men, they were running out of rations. If it hadn't been for old Patton, why, we might have gotten licked over there.
So that was definitely a genuine concern.
Oh, you better believe it. Yeah, this was from the higher ups.
From some things you read, you know, it was really not that.
No, this was bad. Believe me, the Battle of the Bulge was real bad. Matter of fact, they were beginning to wonder. You know, at Bastogne, was it Bastogne?
Yeah, Bastogne was right in the middle there.
Whether that was seemed to be the point, if the Germans would have got that, they went right up into Belgium. You know. The big thing was, you know, after the invasion, we needed ports for our ships to come into. And the big port up in Belgium, Antwerp,
mm-hmm.
That was in the British territory, and they couldn't get Antwerp. The Germans had that so well protected, and Montgomery, he'd try to get in there, and every time they'd start, they'd get beat back again. And Antwerp never became a working port, I don't think, hardly until the end of the war.
Hmm. Now, Bastogne holds up, and of course the German attack sort of peters out. What do you remember about the feeling after it's apparent that they didn't succeed?
Then we just counted the days until it was all over.
Right. Now, as the spring approaches and we're collapsing in, the Russians are coming in from the other side. Was there any feeling that perhaps they should do better, take more territory to keep the Russians from getting in?
Well, this was all political. In other words, this was done, and we had our headquarters had a big part in that, because the British, I can't think of the British man's head name of that, but anyways, FDR's main man was anyways, these people were headquartered in London, flying in and out all the time, and they were using our headquarters as a base to get back to Washington, and we were doing an awful lot of that work there, and that's the political end of the war. In other words, after the fighting was pretty well over, they got to this fighting with Uncle Joe, you know, and Churchill finally found out that Uncle Joe wasn't going to give. And he had lied to Churchill about Poland. Mm-hmm. And I just told my wife the other day, I says, when they were showing President Bush in Hungary and Warsaw, I says, you know, I wish Winston Churchill would be alive today to see this, because actually this is what the war really started over. It was Poland. Mm-hmm. England says, we'll protect you. If Germany invades, we will fight.
So they traded one.
You see, yes. And this is what started the war. And I just wish the Churchill and FDR and these guys would be alive to see I hope is going to happen here now, that we're going to see this Iron Curtain fold. Murray was this man's name, was FDR's chief guy.
What difference do you think might there have been had Roosevelt lived and to deal with us?
No, Roosevelt at his last conference was, I feel certain he didn't know what was going on. He was a sick man.
Yeah. What do you recall about his death?
That was a big thing in England. Just about as big as if the king had died. Because he and Churchill were buddies, you know. After all, FDR, look what he had given England. He would, number one, FDR couldn't wait to get us into the war, and chance came, you know, and it is a good thing, because England, I believe Germany would have beaten England, just like they did France, and if the Japs hadn't invaded Pearl Harbor and got the war, we could go to war against Germany and Japan legally, you know, with some background, after Pearl Harbor, wasn't any question. This is what FDR had been waiting on, was for a good excuse. And like I said in the beginning, when I was drafted for a year. And he said to my parents, we'll never send your sons overseas. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, that was a lie. He knew that was propaganda then. Mm-hmm.
But he had to find a good excuse.
He had to find an excuse.
Now, what was the feeling towards the Germans and, of course, the Japanese as well? Did you guys feel that you were doing the right thing, that this was a real... the right thing to do?
You mean fight?
Yeah, was Roosevelt right, or?
Oh, no doubt about it. Look what Germany did to France, you know, and look what it did to all these other countries that it took.
So there was never any hesitation about it?
No. This was the days before drugs, and this was the days before protests, you know. Mm-hmm. You did as you was told and did it. You were told to salute the flag, you saluted the flag, and then you were told to pledge allegiance, you pledged it, you said the pledge of allegiance. And you never, back in them days, you never thought of burning the American flag. Mm-hmm. Because, listen, every morning we got up at 6 o'clock and we'd have to salute that, you know, at reveille in the evening. We'd have to go out and watch the flag come down, and the flag meant something to us boys, and it still does to me. Mm-hmm. And I think they're right about this decision the Supreme Court just made, you know, that it's all right. I don't agree with that.
Now the...
that's off the subject.
Well, that's okay. Now, as the war's closing in, and of course it's pretty apparent in Germany that that they're done. What feelings do you recall about, you know, finally accomplishing this? And,
How did you do that? After we knew it was over, we just felt bad that Eisenhower was told to stay. As a matter of fact, Eisenhower had to retreat 50, 60 miles, you know, where the line was. It was just too bad that we didn't take more land, or more countries, go into more countries than we could have. We could have gone into Bulgaria, we could have gone into Austria, we could have taken those Balkan countries. Mm-hmm. And of course Churchill, you know, he didn't really want to go across the channel on the invasion. He wanted to whip Germany through the Balkan countries. When he was in Italy, he wanted to go on up through Yugoslavia and Greece and that area.
Do you think there was a real feeling that Stalin was going to keep those countries?
We eventually knew that Stalin was, you know,
was
because when they gave in, when Eisenhower received his orders to fall back, well, we knew that something was wrong.
Hmm. Now,
see, these political guys was right behind the front lines. When they would take a town in Germany, we had a group would come right in and set up a form of government. Because these people didn't have anything to eat.
Right.
They were starving. And we had to give them food. And this was a big thing that most people don't realize, how much food we had to take with us, because from the very beginning of France had been starving for 4 years. So don't forget that they lost the war in 1940. And Hitler and Germany had taken everything out of France, taken it back to England, or back to Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And everywhere we went, if we gained 10 miles, we had to feed everybody in them 10 miles.
Mm-hmm.
Or give them medicine or something. This was a big, big, big thing, because this really slowed the war down. It took food away from us, you know.
Do you think fighting the war fair, whereas the Germans really didn't care, played a role? By fair, I mean taking care of the civilians and...
Well, no, Hitler didn't. From what I've read of Hitler, you know, he didn't have he didn't care about anything but Hitler, Germany.
Now, when
he was a cold-blooded warrior.
When Hitler finally dies, and of course the VE Day is going to fall.
Yeah, that was a big thing when that hit our headquarters. When we decoded that message, I was working that night. Our place was open 24 hours a day, and we had what we call platoons that run everything. In other words, the whole message center, the radio section, and the cryptography, and the teletypes, and anything that was communications, even the transportation, the motorcycles, and so on. We had that too. I didn't tell you about that.
What kind of shifts did you work then?
We worked 8-hour shifts.
Huh.
Mm-hmm.
Now. I interrupted you. What was the feeling then?
When the war was over, well, when we found out that Hitler was killed himself, committed suicide, then we were all thinking about points of getting home. And I think I had 90-some points. That's one of the reasons I got home when I did.
What did you need to get?
I think it was 80-some, I think, would get you home. I forget. I had 90-some.
So you were anxious to get home. Was there any?
Was there any? Over there 4 years.
Was there any chance, any feeling that you might be sent to the Pacific to finish that?
No. We never thought about that, because this is another story. We worked on the Manhattan Project, which was the atom bomb.
Really?
We knew pretty much about that. You see. England was in on that too, and they had a scientific research lab in England, and they were communicating with Bush, and not this President Bush, but another man by the name of Bush, and the general was in charge of that, not Goebbels, but his name, can't think of it anyway.
See, I know about
it. But anyways, We worked on the Manhattan, that was another code name, Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
And we worked on that quite a bit. And then also, we also did a lot of work for the OSS. That was the Office of Scientific Research. And each one of these people had their own separate codes.
Did you have any conception what the atom bomb was going to do?
No.
You had Manhattan Project and you knew
I never will forget, early in the war, I was still out in the morning and the decoding, and I deciphered a message that was top secret, and the word heavy water was in it. Well, when you decipher a message, you go through it to see if everything's all right before you turn it in. And heavy water. Well, now you know, you and me, heavy water don't sound right. But you know what heavy water was back in them days. This was when they invaded Norway, when they thought maybe Hitler was working on the atom bomb. And this was the Manhattan Project. And they invaded Norway, and they was afraid that Hitler was going to get some heavy water. Well, the average person, and I was the average person, and I didn't know what heavy water was.
Did you think it was a mistake in the code?
Yeah, it was a mistake in the code. I went back, I remember going over that. And then after heavy water, when you're starting to read about heavy water, it comes back clearly about that message, and that was back early in the war.
Hmm. Now, the Japanese are pretty well beaten back, but it looks as though the invasion of Japan is going to occur when they finally do drop the bomb. Do you remember where you were when the bombs were
dropped? I was in England.
Still in England?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I didn't get home until October, and that was in August.
What do you recall about hearing that news?
Well, I probably, I can't remember. I decoded the message of FDR died that was released in England. I can't remember about the atom bomb. We got all that. We knew all that was going on.
Did you finally put the Manhattan Project together in the bombs?
Yeah. But you see, we weren't allowed to talk about it. Mm-hmm. Even us guys who worked in Dakota, we weren't really supposed to communicate with each other about mm-hmm. what we'd seen or what we'd done.
Mm.
Matter of fact, you were talking about security. They used to follow us around quite a bit. You know, especially if you went into a bar and they'd be next to you. You know, but you could pick them guys out.
Did they listen in on conversations?
They always, you know, snuggle up to you. And,
Now, you're going to hightail it for home as soon as you possibly can. What's the feeling you got as you got back to the United States and, of course, back to Ohio?
Well, it's all over now. Let's get married.
When did you meet your wife?
Oh, I've been going with her for all during the war.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
A lot of messages back and forth for them?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah, we were high school sweethearts.
Really? That's good.
Matter of fact, she worked for my dad.
At the Amy's
store.
As you look back on the war effort and of course, you know, the whole country was behind the thing, what feelings do you get about the accomplishment of beating these?
Well, we had to beat Hitler. I mean, we couldn't live with that. And you know, when you were in the service, they showed you all the propaganda films, you know, why you were doing what you were doing. And I never had any qualms about fighting in the war.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought it was my duty.
Now, looking back, and you know, considering today's point of view, do you feel any animosity, any hatred towards the Germans or the Japs?
No, I might about the Japs because the Japs have gotten so far ahead of us, you know, in communications, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
Now today, I'm sure, and I don't know this, but I'm sure we're doing pretty much what I did in cryptography on the chip.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty certain of that. Mm-hmm. If they aren't, they better be doing it.
Yeah. Okay, that's basically all I wanted to cover. It's a lot of detailed things that I didn't have any conception of, but I appreciate your time. And
well, cryptography is a real interesting thing. You know, I've read all the books that have been released, there's been some real good books released about Enigma, in other words, the big secret code machine that, or Ultra, that was called
the Ultra
yeah. The big code machine they had. Now, I might tell you a little bit about that. A half a dozen or so of us guys were picked to run conferences between Churchill and Roosevelt. And as I said, everything went through our headquarters. Now, they actually took place down at number 10 Downing Street, where Churchill was. And it was a very simple operation, and since then I've read in books that Germany intercepted all those conferences.
This is between Roosevelt and Churchill.
Yeah. This is before we really had real secret, what we call one-time tapes. Mm. When they started out, they were just using pretty much a telephone scrambler. You know what a telephone scrambler is.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they found out that there was a leak somewhere, then they started with one-time tapes. Now, one-time tape, you might have read about that, is where a tape is used to encipher a message, and then it's immediately burnt, so it can't be used again. In other words, that sequence of letters will never come up again.
Hmm. Well, how would it be decoded then?
Well, they had the same thing in Washington.
Oh, but then they would
burn
theirs?
They burn theirs, too.
Huh.
Oh, yeah. One-time tapes.
Pretty,
yeah.
Pretty foolproof?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it could be broken.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Hmm. Now,
see, even our Sagaba machines, during the first few weeks of the invasion, after the breakouts, GIs, you know, they'll do some crazy things. And apparently they were traveling through a town in France somewhere, and they had the Sagaba code machine on their, in their trailer, in their truck. They went in to get something to drink, I suppose, and looking for some gals, and when they come back out, their truck was gone. Now this put one terrific scare into our security system. Matter of fact, we went off of our security system and went to a real low-grade code for a few days because we didn't know where that code machine was.
Hmm.
We thought maybe the Germans might have got it.
What ended up happening?
Ended up, they found it in the lake.
Who would have put it there?
Well, who knows?
No.
But anyways, that was just one of the scares we had because the German could have gotten, you know, our code machine. And apparently they must have gotten some of our code machines because we got all theirs. You know, when we'd overrun a German communication system, we'd get their stuff. And apparently they'd overrun us somewhere. We had to take that. But you see, we changed our code sometimes as often as every 4 or 5 hours.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. At least every 24.
Well, how would you let everybody know that you were on a different code?
You read code books, you know,
mm-hmm.
You read code books. And every day, the adjutant general who run everything in the service would come down to our to our office, and they'd give us what we're going to use today, our settings and everything.
So it would be the same thing for everybody, then?
Yeah, everybody had the same. Well, you had to. So you had all your messages was depended on that date up there.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the time, the date. You'd have your books to say if it's 12 noon or 3 o'clock or something, then you'd look in your book and you know if there was a change between that.
Well, what would happen if you didn't do it right? Would it the message?
Nobody would get it. No, wouldn't get encoded. Well, you could go back. Suppose you made a mistake, and we were trained in that. Things that can happen. Suppose you transfer when you set your, and this often happens when you set your machine up, these 5 wheels that we had, and suppose you say A, B, C, D, E, and you did made a mistake, you transposed A, B, C, or A, C, B, you transposed them to, and we go through all the different suppositions that it could happen, and sometimes you would be able to break it.
Hmm.
But the top secret stuff all had to be checked by another person that out of our code room. In other words, you'd set it up and then you'd had to go through, I can show you. I was a crew chief. I was responsible for my platoon later on. I was responsible for everything that went out of there. And at one time, a top urgent message that the Navy was sending came down to our office. Now, the Navy used a different code than we did. We weren't allowed the Navy code rooms, so they weren't allowed in ours. I think they used the same machines but a different set of wheels. But anyways, in the early part of the war, a convoy was coming across. This is during the African War. A convoy was coming across, and they were supposed to be diverted. They were heading for Ireland. They were supposed to be diverted to go down to the African end of it. The Navy brought this message to us, and we set it up in our code, and we put it out. And Washington claims they never got that. And it never got to the people at sea either. And the radio man and myself, we were calling the carpet. They were about to break us because they figured we didn't do it, you know. But we had proof that we had sent it.
How did you keep track of what you sent?
Everything was that I did had to be by officer. Either he was a captain or above lieutenants, commissioned officer. They had to sign for everything. They were supposed to check it, but some of them second Louis that we got over there, we called them cannon fodder, you know. They were sent over from Washington, 90 Day Wonders. They were sent to our headquarters to find out how we operated. And then they went out in the field somewhere. Very few of them came back.
What was the attitude towards the officers? Were they...
We had some good ones, we had some bad ones. Yeah. It's just like it's... Just like every day, you know, you had some bums and you had some gentlemen. These 90-day wonders, they were, of course, we were all top grade, you know, non-commissioned officers in our place. And we didn't have any use for these second movies. But the captains and the from there on out, they were good men. Most of them were.
I just have one more question.
Yeah, go ahead.
What effect do you think that had on you after the war? Did it change the way you looked at things?
Well, after the war was over, before the war was over, we were called over to American Embassy. Now, American Embassy, the State Department, was still using an obsolete code all during the war. Now, an obsolete code is what we call strip code. Very, very slow. Non-electric, in other words, all manual. So, as I was getting ready to leave, we were dismantling our headquarters, and was about ready to close down. And we were taking all of our equipment to the American Embassy across the street, you might say. And they just pleaded with us, they would give us a job, working for the State Department. In other words, get our discharge over a month. But the catch was, we weren't allowed to come home for another year. And we all wanted to come home for at least 30 days. Because, hey, we've been away from home for 4 years. We don't want to come home for 30 days. You know? But, I turned down a good job, I'm sure.
Yeah, that probably could have led to something.
Yeah.
So you ended up coming back here and...
Coming back here.
Getting a job and...
Yeah.
Okay. I appreciate your time and everything.
Yeah. I'll just show you a couple of things.